welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who wishes that he were an extra in a 1980s movie. It's Chris Kelly.
Hello, everyone.
So, I was watching this movie Valley Girl that we're talking about, and I've watched, you know, you watch movies from the 80s, particularly filmed in California or New York, and the extras are so much, I feel like the extras were better then than they are now that you're watching it. Because in this movie, in Valley Girl, there's dancing scenes, there's, you know, people in the background of the beach in restaurants, and they all nail it. The extras in Valley Girl are A-OK. So what movie would you want to be an extra in the 1980s?
Oh, that's a very tough question. Maybe Valley Girl, but I don't know. I know that movie was very fastly made, and it was very, like, extremely cheap. So it was like they were using a lot of their own clothes and a lot of their own. So, and they were, a lot of them were just there being paid for food for, and they were like,
yeah, pulled off the street.
Quite literally. Yeah. And so a lot of them were having a lot more fun with it because it's kind of like they were there and they said, hey, how about you just go over here, order a couple of hot dogs? Here's $5. So they're like, hey.
Sweet.
Okay. So, it's like, that's why it looked really believable for Valley Girl, because those people were not acting. They were quite literally the guys ordering a slice of pizza.
During the prom scene at the end, they brought in two rival fraternities. And, you know, on film sets, I worked on a film set one time with like 400 extras, and I was finding some going and sleeping in storage containers. Like, yeah. They disappear. So they had two frats that were rivals on this scene. And I was listening to a Kevin Smith, Smoviola interview, an hour-long interview with Martha Coolidge, the DP, Frederick Elms, and then Deborah Foreman. And these two frats started fighting. They drove a car into the place. Because there's so much downtime, and when you rival frats and there's downtime, they were getting into fights. So yeah, they brought in some pretty gnarly extras in Valley Girl. But I gotta say, I want to be in Rocky IV. I want to be one of the scientists, right, that is watching Dolph kick things and punch things and run around, and then I have a notebook just going like nodding up and down like impressive, like he hits the thing and he gets 7,000, you know,
1800 per pounds per square inch.
Yeah, and I'm like, just, oh, good job. And I'm like writing on a piece of paper, you know, I have a buzz cut, I look Russian. That's what I mean. If I could transport myself back in time, that's the extra role I would want to be in the 1980s.
Maybe one of the Friday the 13th ones.
Oh.
Because they always had a good time on those.
Yeah, you're right.
Or Blues Brothers. I'd love to be on Blues Brothers. I knew a guy that was a crane operator on Blues Brothers. And he was like, we were shit-faced the entire show. he was like, man, that was one big party.
You would just be in the club, right? You would be one of the guys in the club.
Listening to the Plimsolls.
Yeah.
Hey, what happened to them? Like, they just kind of went down. What was it? The one guy? He wound up managing Metallica, or was that the Paolas? They made a joke about that in the...
I don't remember.
The documentary Making of a Monster. He was like, James Hetfield said, play us one of those Paola riffs. And he's like, wait, what did he... Like, did anybody else catch that? That he just mentioned a band that was not very well known at all?
Nice. So you're thinking Blues Brothers?
Blues Brothers, maybe. Maybe one of the Friday the 13th, because they were always in the woods. Probably not Takes Manhattan, because I don't think I would really want to be...
So you'd be one of the extra counselors that doesn't have any lines?
Yeah, that would be nice.
Just kind of show up and kind of nod and look at a clipboard.
Yeah, look at a clipboard and be like, oh, right over there is the archery. Do a lot of pointing.
You do a cross in the background when main people are talking. You just do a cross. And for some reason, extras don't move their arms when they walk. So you just have dead arms walking in the background.
You move your arms when you walk?
Yeah. If you want to see...
Was that a Seinfeld episode where it's like...
Oh, yeah. Do you not move your arms? If you want to see a very random extra moment in the movie Spy... Very funny comedy, directed by Paul Feig, starring Melissa McCarthy. But there's a scene where Rose Byrne and another actress are walking down the street. They're probably going about 100 yards. And right behind them, there's this extra. And for some reason, he just has his hand in his pocket. So this entire scene, you're watching it, and you're like, why does that guy have his hand in his pocket? And he's doing fine. He's like a Bulgarian extra. But I was listening to the commentary for it, and Paul Feig's like, why did I not catch this? All I can look at is this guy with his hand in his pocket. Actually, I'd want to be that extra, the guy with his hand in his pocket.
See, that way you can recognize him, and then people will bring it up later on in commentaries and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then, you know, whenever they show that, he shows that movie to people, he's like, you see that guy with the hand in his pocket?
Paul Feig's like, that idiot.
Even see it coming. He was so stupid.
But in this movie, I don't know, just watching all of them do their 80s dances, we're hyper aware of extras because we've worked on the sets. And so, but watching a lot of the extras dance, they did a good job in this.
I think a lot of it had to do with them working for free as well. I mean, she says that in the commentary. I mean, this was a very micro-budget film. It was three
300,000, and then they took 25,000 away.
Yeah, so there you go. They had, like, no money, so a lot of them were for free, and as we both know from having free extras, you really can't... You can suggest things, but you can't sit there and say, you have to only do this.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can say, oh, okay, well, don't look too ridiculous, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know, we really can't do that, and it's like, they show up wearing their clothes. Thank God most of them had neon, because that's what they wanted to go for.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to show the contrast between the Valley and the Hollywood guys. So a lot of them had, like, those pastels and neons and everything. They looked really ridiculous, especially to us nowadays. But that was the look back.
That was the look. Pop collars.
Yeah. Double popped collar. Remember when that came back when we were in college? I know, because I did that. And then I got made fun of so bad for it.
I never popped the collar. I wanted to do the triple pop collar one time. I don't know how to do that, but I wanted to triple pop. But yeah, and also what I like is the extras in this movie. I listened to the commentary. Martha Coolidge talks a lot about this movie, and I love it. And I'm actually, I'm teaching production design right now, a class, and I'm going to show them this movie because they only had a $3,000 art budget. So I'm going to walk them through the different scenes and kind of talk to them about how you can maximize your art department budget.
Yeah, I mean, cool. One of the best ways to do it is just find artistic people that are okay with you filming at their place, especially, I think she talks about it in the commentary, the house that was used for... Deborah Foreman's house, the people who lived there were actually very eclectic, so thank God.
Wasn't there a drug dealer? There's a drug dealer in the house, right? That got arrested. So they were doing scenes, her and Nicolas Cage. No, she was at her house.
I know there was a scene where it was like, what was the scene right before they leave for the prom that they said, like, almost as soon as they said cut, they had to walk out because they were having a party. So they're like bringing their gear out. So then it's like, apparently there's like people you can see moving in the background, and that's the actual party members that are coming in for this party. Funny. But it kind of matched it because it's supposed to be... They're going to the prom. So I was like, oh, they're dressed up anyway. So, hey.
That's fun. and also, they were doing a scene and didn't have any permits for this movie.
Martha Coolidge, gosh, it was like rocking.
All these cops came into the house. I heard this on the Smoviola thing with Kevin Smith. And these cops ran in like, we're going to get shut down. Our production's done. It's all over. But they went and kicked down a door and arrested a guy who was arrested for drug dealing. And then they just let them keep shooting. That's what they shot this movie.
I guess at that point, like, who's your target right there? People without the permit, or the guy who's selling the drugs?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, yeah, we'll just get the drug dealer. Maybe we'll send someone next.
We'll come back for you later. And they also, Martha Coolidge is something really smart, too, where she played, so the bands lip-synced, but they played music over it. So the bands could play with the music, like on music videos, and then people had some rhythm to dance to.
Yeah.
So sometimes you see these movies where it's completely quiet, and you're like, extras, dance! And extras are like, I don't know what to move my body to.
They play that first 5 seconds of like a bass beat, and it's like, I don't know, I'm just hearing It's like, I don't know what that is. So, but they actually played the songs, and then they got to actually play. And what the Plimsolls, who was actually like a band at the time, was getting fairly well known with other bands, she says in the commentary. And they were doing really successful, and she was like, great, we can use this band. So they played for free.
Did you know that there has been a remake made and shot of this film?
It's a musical.
Yeah,
and
musical.
They shot it, what was it, like a year or two?
A year ago. And it stars Jessica Roth from Happy Death Day. She's awesome.
Yeah.
And she's in La La Land. She's one of the one of the roommates.
Yeah.
One of Emma, she's awesome in that. And then they also had Josh Whitehouse who can sing. They have a character. She's from Riverdale. Like, they have Mae Whitman in there. Like, Chloe Bennett from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But you know what it is? They cast Logan Paul. Logan Paul has a role in it. He's that YouTube kid that went to the death forest. He like tased a dead squirrel.
Oh, yeah.
He's always saying.
That was not like, I don't understand that video. I was like, why would you record someone?
So someone hung, right? Didn't they show footage of a guy who was hung?
He started making fun of the guy. And I was like, why would you do that?
And so a lot of controversy around him. So they didn't release it. So they had this finished film just waiting to be released. They're going to release the Anne Hathaway Rebel Wilson remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or Used Cars, one of those remakes. But it's with them. They're going to put that in that spot. So they're just waiting to release this.
Do you think Dirty Rotten Scoundrels would work nowadays?
I mean, you'd have to.
As funny? I don't know.
I mean, everything gets remade. So remakes typically don't work. So 1 in 3 actually work.
I mean, if they made it take place in the 80s, but of course, like, if they made an update of it, it's kind of like my argument with When a Stranger Calls. It's like, well, all you got to do is look at the phone.
Like, I don't have any cell service.
Yeah, right? Like, that movie is very fast. They could have just cut that in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't understand how there was any suspense. But
so, I mean, we'll see. And it's just interesting that this movie's sitting on the shelf, just hanging out because of the
antics. I mean,
that
does happen. Antics. Like, Case 39, which I remember when I used to do blogs. This is many years ago, when that was one of the first ones I did. It's like, I wonder what case 1 through 38 was. And that movie sat on the shelf for, I think it was like 4 years. And they're waiting for Renee Zellweger or Bradley Cooper's career to pick up because they were unknowns at the time. Well, I mean, well, not.
No, you're talking about Texas Chainsaw. That's the other one. So Renee Zellweger's been in two delayed horror films.
She was, but then she did Bridget Jones, and then that's kind of what brought her back. And
Case 39.
Case 39
came out.
Happening.
Like, shit.
they were sitting there going, oh, okay, well, everyone liked Hangover, so here's Case 39 with Bradley Cooper. And yep. That was, I mean, whatever. I thought they had one really good line in it, which the little girl, when she talks in her demon voice, she's like, and she said, I forget what she says. She's like,
Case 36 was the best, but Case 35 is second. This Case 39, I don't like.
I haven't gotten over Case 33.
That was a long one. I haven't been saying.
It's a big cigarette in the hand.
That Case 33. You don't know those movies. Hey, let's pull a Bulgaria. But Bulgaria didn't work. Well, we'll try it again. Hey, let's pull a Case 17. That didn't work. Well, at least it wasn't Case 12. You're right.
Yeah, but do you remember Case 19?
No, because I was on peyote the whole time.
72 days later, I woke up.
And then I guess we had done three cases in between then.
I was in the Grand Canyon. It was really beautiful, but man, it was dehydrated.
I guess one of the cases was you finding me.
That was case 22.
Sorry about that. Sorry.
Yeah. All right, back to case 25.
I can't go back to that. I lost two fingers. Three toes.
I grew back the one toe on my finger.
They grew back. I need more cigarettes. That reminds me of case 3. The case of the missing cigarette case. we weren't making much money back then.
I was really pissed about losing $5.
Someone thought that a ghost stole a case of cigarettes. It was just her husband.
Turns out it was a haunted cigarette case and it stole itself.
The weird thing is, no one stole it. The cigarette case just disappeared into a portal.
It was still there. I was really kind of confused with case 7.
Have you seen Poltergeist? The Poltergeist stole cigarettes. Apparently they smoke. Demons smoke cigarettes.
I didn't know they liked camels.
I mean, how are we going to get those back? That raised more questions than answers.
Speaking of smoking in movies, Nicolas Cage in Valley Girl. Remember that? they're outside of the movie theater. And he's smoking a cigarette.
With his 3D glasses?
Michael Bowen, yeah. Bowen's like, oh, cool. Is this movie in 3D? He's like, no, but your face is. Yeah.
He got a lot of different jobs. All right, so let's. I guess we'll lead into this movie. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that was enough.
So this is directed by Martha Coolidge, written by Andrew Wayne and Lane Crawford, and the DP was Frederick Elms, who shot like everything Blue Velvet.
He shot like everything that David Lynch did.
He had done Eraserheart before this movie. And so
yeah, Eraserhead.
Martha Coolidge
did a ton of Go-Go's music videos, which is probably the reason why they leaned more towards him, because he did a lot of 80s music videos. He shot one of my favorite films, Wild at Heart.
Yep. That's a good movie right there.
The Namesake, which if people haven't seen that, you could see Kumar in a decent role.
Cage and Dern.
What?
Nicolas Cage.
No, right? I was talking about The Namesake.
Oh, The Namesake.
That,
oh,
that was like whenever he was at, Cal Penn. He was actually like he's a really good actor. And that's one of the ones he did. And then he also shot Horns.
Oh, Horns. Nice. Yeah, that's a good look. Oh, Aja. Oh. He always makes movies look pretty good. Alejandro Aja.
Yeah, he's got a great eye. I can't wait for him to make another movie.
Yeah. Martha Coolidge was given $300,000. The executives told her, we have a script called Valley Girl. It's based off like kind of, they thought it was like a Frank Zappa kind of, oh, Valley Girl, Valley Speak kind of talk.
Yeah, they thought they were going to, they'd be able to use that song, but Zappa's not really big into doing that.
And they look at it, they tell Martha Coolidge, here's a script. We need four, all right, so we're not going to go tune this, but like we need four pairs of breasts in the movie.
She talks about that in the commentary. Yeah,
and
like,
she's
we
like,
don't care
our first
where,
one. She's like,
where they're at. Yep. We just need to have them.
Yeah, four pairs. And you have $300,000 and you don't need an art department. And she was actually able to say, hey, I need $3,000 for this. So she has her $300,000. Actually, during the commentary, she said that the majority of the people on this film worked for free, except for the heads of department. So she took she got $5,000 for this as a director. And then the rest of the people just got paid a very little amount of money. And so, you know, you had a 16-year-old boy doing the costume, teenager doing the costuming for the punks, because he was the son of the production designer or costume designer or friend of that. So you really low budget movie. They were just expecting a movie that could market, make 3 million probably, right? Yeah. In the theaters.
They probably weren't expecting it to actually make, what, 16.7 mil.
Yeah.
And it really did explode, especially at the time. And I mean, it was such a relatable film. I mean, it's Romeo and Juliet. Everyone can relate to that story. So, yeah. And you had, actors and actresses that weren't really well known. They were all TV actors. So, you know, and then of course we have Nicolas Cage.
18 years
freshly
old.
18, according to the commentary.
18 years old.
Insane. And he's so good. And and she even pointed out like how he does with his improv, like the whole, with them driving down the road and he's like shouting things at people. And it's interesting to see like how his genius actually works. I mean, of course, we all know Nicolas Cage now for all the ridiculous movies. And of course, you know him going in every movie that he does. But if you think about it, it's quite genius what he does, and it's really hard to keep up that level of mentality for as long as you do it. And it shows with Valley Girl, with everything he does. They gave him a lot of improv to do. He was given open range to do what he wants. Even the small things, what was it? She talks about was like when he's not wearing his shirt at the beach. And she said, like, he was apparently, even though he was the youngest one, he was the hairiest one. And she said that she was like, well, just, you know, just clean yourself up a little bit. So he shaves like a
Superman.
Superman
on his chest.
He does. And it became very symbolic, because then that's whenever you saw more of these beach shows coming out and they all wanted to do that because it looked cool.
And just 18 years old, Deborah Foreman was on this. Did you hear what her manager? So I was her manager wanted her to get this movie, but her manager did something shicey. She's like, listen, Debbie has a movie filming in France. We need to get this movie. So if you don't say yes immediately, Debbie Foreman's going to France to make a movie called, you know, Les Gentils, J'ai jamais, Foudou Fafa.
Merlot.
Yeah. And so Flight of the Conchords. I wasn't doing a French horrible. I was quoting it. But so they were like, okay, we'll bring her in. And these two actually started dating per the commentary for a while.
Yeah, he actually had a real crush on her. He would send her poetry.
And they said, yeah, American Girl or something. He wrote American something. He wrote a poem for her. Isn't that all, like,
yeah, that's really cute, and it shows in their acting back and forth. I mean, you could tell there was real chemistry between the two. They were really quite adorable with each other.
That breakup scene, she's really crying. They couldn't do it, and so
it was so hard. It's so heartbreaking because it's like he's really confused, and it's like how are you going to do this to him? He's so sweet and so nice to you, and it's because, you know, your friends don't approve of him. That they approve of Michael Bowen, who's like a massive jerk in the movie. And it's like, well, he's like the cool guy, and, you know, don't you want to be like, you know, best friends with all of us? And she's like, yeah, I guess. So she sides with them, and it's like, oh no. And he's such a, I love that you know, the scene where he's like, he's cursing at her, then he's like, F off, like, totally, for sure.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna get our PG-13 rating. But he's walking away and he goes, fuck off, for sure, like, totally. But that's
a great line.
And she, you know, she was crying though. She was,
she was
crying in that scene. Like, cause they were together. They were dating, I guess. And also what I like about this movie. So, all right, Apocalypse Now. It's a weird to combine these two, but Apocalypse Now was Coppola, and she was associated with Coppola through Zoetrope, who made, like, produced Godfather, Lost in Translation, and all those. Apocalypse Now used 1.5 million feet of film. 1.5 million feet.
God.
This movie only had 60,000. So they only cut, remember she said the director's cut only had about
everything that they shot was in the movie. Yeah. But I think she said at the most there might be 30 seconds extra.
So they shot, like, it's crazy. So they allowed improv, but they didn't, like, it had to be within the scene. It couldn't be like a Judd Apatow. Like,
they couldn't just be rolling, like, okay, let's see it again. Now say it with ketchup or something. They couldn't do that. It was like, but if he rattled something off, like, she's like, say something insulting. And he says, F off, like, totally, for sure. And then it's like, okay, well, that's good.
We can't use any more film. They were worried too. They're like, we're going to run out of film.
Of course.
And I also like that I'm actually going to teach this to my class. They had such a low budget, she storyboarded almost everything. And so when they went to shoot, I mean, they had to go real low budget, but they had an idea of everything they had to shoot. And so they saved a lot of money by prep and rehearsal. And I thought, I don't know, I love, all right, so you,
they did the same thing with the Reanimator. They rehearsed it, I think it was like for about 2 weeks before they actually filmed it, which they, if you listen to the commentary on Reanimator, he explains this, that they wanted to rehearse it all like one big play. So that way, when they actually showed up, and they should do this with more movies, in my opinion. Budgeting and, you know, getting scheduled to work out, you probably can't really do that with people with bigger names. But they rehearsed it like one big play, And then they rehearsed it right there on set and then shot it. And then that was it. It was just like,
Saved so much money.
And not only that, what makes it even more intense is that they open up for improv.
Yeah.
It's like, how could you like do that with improv too? But it worked great.
They do that on the Edgar Wright sets. I don't know if you... Did you get to work on Baby Driver? I wasn't available to work on that. Oh, no, that was... we were on something else. But yeah, so they... on that movie, what... this is off target, so whatever. But Edgar Wright, when he makes a movie, when they get the set, when they start shooting, everything is in the script. Like, they don't change anything on the day. But they do extensive rehearsals. And if improv comes out of those rehearsals, like you said... Then they can add that in there because they figured it out in rehearsing.
That makes a lot of sense to me to be able to do that because that way it looks more fresh and more real. But you're still following the script.
And since you told me about this movie, I want you to tell the audience what the studio executives said during their first screening of this movie. What did they look at Martha Coolidge and say? Do you remember that?
Oh, I forget what she said. She said like they liked it or something.
Yeah, they're like, you made a real movie.
Yeah. That's what she said. Yeah, you made a real movie.
And they they took full page billboards, full page in New York and LA. They put billboards up. They tried to sell it. Isn't that awesome, though?
Yeah.
Here's 300,000. We need four boobs. We'll make $2 million on it, whatever. And then they watch it and they go, you made a real movie. Isn't that pretty cool?
I love that. And I mean, she's quite happy with it, obviously.
I just bet those guys were high fiving each other. And you know what's interesting? Martha Coolidge, she also said she borrowed money from her parents during the filming of these 20 days. And the DP, Frederick Elms, what I love is we actually talked about this with the guests where the Adam Wingard's like, I hate being on set. Frederick was like, it was a nightmare. He's like, I don't even know how I stayed awake. It was 20 hours every day because we shot in 20 days. So this was like a tough, tough film to shoot in those 20 days. But they kept the budget down and did a great job.
They must have been recycling a lot of extras, especially for the party scenes.
Yeah, they must have.
They had been like, okay, well then you're good. Go
cast and crew, like boyfriends of the, you know, anybody who's on there, boyfriend, girlfriends. Also, I know you heard this in the commentary, but I love in the beginning when you watch it, so I knew nothing about this movie when I first watched it. Really, I didn't know how popular it was. I knew Martha Coolidge from Real Genius. So I watched this movie and the heavy valley speak in the beginning was just, I was like,
Elizabeth Daly, who we all know as Tommy Pickles, and Froggy from Little Rascals. But she didn't really know how to talk like that. So she just kind of like mimicked whatever she thought. And then they went to certain malls and listened to what people would say. And then she just kind of morphed it in her own like, oh my God, gag me with a spoon.
Yeah. And some real big quotes came from that. And you know what I thought was interesting what Coolidge did is that they started really heavy in the beginning with the valley speak. So you're like, oh, okay, I get it. But then they're like, we couldn't do that the whole shoot. So they went really heavy in the beginning and then they dialed it back throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So when they added it in, you were used to that kind of vibe. That's really interesting. Maybe not subconscious, just load you up front really heavy with it. So you're like, holy crap, this is the world. And then they kind of weaned back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they did it throughout the entire film, it would be a nightmare.
I'd be screaming.
Exactly.
Stop.
I guess probably Elizabeth Daly was like the predominant character that would talk like that. So then her character didn't become as dominant as she was in the beginning. Like she kind of feathers out, but then again, the movie's not about her. It's about Nick Cage and Deborah Foreman.
And I love the line where in the beginning, so she's dating Tommy, the pop collar guy who likes to eat her sandwiches.
He was like our age.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. But I love contrast between the other
people. He was a big dude. But I love, she's like, Tommy can be such a dork. His brains are bad news. And then they're like, he is bitching. I'm becoming to think I'm an old chair.
Like you're just totally grody.
Yeah. Like in the beginning though, you're like, wow, this is a lot. But it's pretty interesting that in the beginning she breaks up with Tommy and then you know what I like about this movie too is why I think it works is that the side characters, like the parents,
who came from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, who came from Apocalypse Now, her parents, so Julie's parents, Sarah and Steve, they're the opposite of the normal 80s parents. Like, come back next Tuesday and it's a Friday.
Hey man, we remember the 60s, man. Remember he blows out his water buffaloes and he's like, did I get these at Woodstock or was this the March on Washington?
Yeah.
So you were right the first time, honey, and it was 14 years ago.
Because you wanted comfortable shoes.
Yeah, you're going to do a lot of walking.
He's like, oh yeah, but you have.
I love how they're doing. They do a health food store.
Oh yeah,
just like they're just the customers that were in there are really funny too. And he's like, I don't know who this Randy guy is, man, but I think he's bad news. And then the customer's like eating the you know the vegan burger. And he's like, maybe I should talk to her.
He's like, we got some new stuff. You can stop by. Like, yeah. And also, you have Susie and Beth, Susie and her stepmom Beth, who both like Skip. Then you have Tommy and that really...
That's a great little side story. Yeah, I love that. That's a great little side thing. And then like the whole scene, like whenever they're having sex and it's like, who is actually the one having the
stepmom,
sex?
Because
stepmom opens up the door and it's like, oh my gosh!
And then Martha Coolidge goes, that's our fourth. And then also, you know, you just have Tommy. You have that really awkward scene that he has with that girl where she's like, are we going together? It's like, no. But if you tell anybody, the ex-boyfriend.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, so, he's like, she's like, well, that's really shitty what you're doing. Yeah. And he's like, I don't know what's worse. Like the fact that you're a shitty friend taking advantage of me. And it's like, I like how she put that in there about how certain guys just treat women like complete garbage.
She said
and
that was like, her most proud point.
That was a great moment. I love that part because it's like, yeah, that dude's that guy.
Tommy.
I was about to say the F-bomb. So.
Yeah, we already got our PG-13.
That guy's a shithead.
Yeah.
He's a terrible human being. And it's like, I like how, you know, she showed that, but, you know, her friend doesn't want to say like, well, how do you know he's such a shitty person? And what's she going to say? Like, oh, you know, he ate your French fries.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, or she going to say, like, I almost had sex with him. Or, yeah. You know, like, oh, come on.
You can't
like,
say anything.
You can't. I mean, what are you going to say? And I love that, how she put that in there in that movie. And then at the end where he gets his just desserts, quite literally.
You know? Can't fight. But she did some other really smart things, too, where Tommy starts eating Julie's food when they get back together.
Yeah.
Martha said she hated that.
Yeah.
She's like, I hate this. And then the other scene where
You see that in Deborah's face, too. She's like, what are you doing?
And that was just a cheese. That was a bun with a piece of cheese on it. There was no meat.
Well, that's where that 300,000 comes from.
Exactly.
There's budget cuts hit everybody, yeah, Mark.
And then only eating you go to a restaurant, can I have a burger without the burger? Like, can I pay $2?
Can I get a condiment sandwich?
Yeah, exactly. And then I like the scene where they go to the club with Nick Cage and his buddy.
That was the Viper Room.
The Viper Room, which is crazy.
It was it was called Filthy McNasty's, but then it was turned into the Central whenever they shot it there. And then it was bought by Johnny Depp later on called the Viper Room.
They're looking at Julie and just telling her how life is. So you have many instances of...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
You can just tell how... I know this... Well, like, you could just tell a woman directed it. Like, it doesn't have the dudes wouldn't have thought about that, especially making this movie.
Yeah. I love how she put that, you know, they're giving, you know, the guys are giving the girls shit and the girls give it right back to them. Because they're just like, when she says, well, it's not so much what we do, you know, it's like we do things differently.
Yeah.
And it's like, but we're the same. Like, she's like, you know, basically like, you look just like your friend. What are you talking about? You know, it's like, yes, of course. And it's like, great. That's a great line. And she gives it right back to them.
Yeah, it was refreshing to watch. I guess I didn't know what to expect from this movie at all.
It's not like a typical romantic comedy where it's not like, you know, the man is overpowered. He doesn't look like the hero except for at the end. And, you know, he gets his ass whooped in the beginning.
Yeah. Tommy destroys him. But I mean, that's...
He beats the hell out of him,
Tommy,
but it's like...
Tommy would, though. That's because he's 35.
Yeah. He has plenty of time to practice jujitsu.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he gets rocked. And I also like how Nick Cage was casted. Remember, they were trying to bring in a ton of pretty boys.
Yeah, and she says that in the commentary, she says that she didn't like the pretty boys, and she picks up the first person who was on the rejected pile, was Nicolas Cage. She says, I want a guy that looks like this. And then they bring him in for the interview, and Nicolas Cage is saying, like, oh, well, I'm actually shooting a movie called Rumblefish right now. So she's like, well, I know Francis, so I'm going to call him and ask him. Francis Ford Coppola. She talks to him and says, do you have a Nicolas Cage over there? Because I really want to use him for my movie Valley Girl. And he goes, no, but we have my nephew, Nicky Coppola. And she's like, aha. So then she started doing a little bit more research on Nicolas Cage. You can read and hear about this, but on Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was the movie, I think it was still in the process of being coming out at that point. He was supposed to have because this is 1983, so 1982, so it would have been still in the, it may actually have been in theaters. I don't know.
Yeah, right about then.
That he was supposed to have a much bigger role, but apparently he was a massive pain in the ass to work with. They even say this in the commentary that he was like walking around. He was like 17. So, yeah. I mean, come on. What 17-year-old isn't a pain in the ass? So he was saying like, you know, oh, well, I'm going to be famous. You know, like my uncle's Francis Coppola, you know, the Godfather. No. And they're all like, you know, Sean Penn's like, oh, okay, yeah. dick. And, you know, like Eric Stoltz is like sitting there like, oh, you're an asshole, you know, F you.
Judge Reinhold beats him up. Judge
Reinhold. What happened to that guy? He's doing Beethoven's Ninth or something.
He's, you know, he had such an earnest, he had such an earnest presence on screen, Judge Reinhold.
And like, even on Gremlins, he was even though he's supposed to be a jerk, he still like looked like a good, strong guy.
He could be in a wrong running TV show, Judge Reinhold.
He, you know what? That's probably going to be his next move. He's going to be just like one of the other stars that like, James Spader.
Oh,
he made a roaring comeback.
Private Practice. No, not Private Practice.
Black Hats.
Blacklist.
There we go, yeah.
But there are villains who wear black hats. Then he did that one lawyer show that he won all the Emmys for.
Oh, gosh.
Spader shows up on screen and he gets Emmys.
But he's a good presence. It's kind of like Mark Paul Gosling.
Yeah, he keeps acting.
He's going.
He's in tons of stuff. He'll be in a show that gets canceled, then he gets a lead on another show. Hey, I'm happy for him. This is awesome.
He's doing great.
And one interesting thing, Nick Cage slept in his car during the filming of this. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
So he went method. And they're like, well, what if we move the location? How are we getting in touch with you? And he's like, I'll just show up. So Martha was like, can't you just sleep at someone's house? So I'm going to sleep in my car and I'll use my payphone. What a turd on this. But I think it worked with his authenticity and what he brought. I mean, he may have slept in his car, but he was... She said she loved him at the end of the day. She said that he really worked his butt off.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He did a lot of great scenes, very memorable things. Well, I liked, one of the things I liked a lot was the scene where they're like on a mountaintop. It's him and his buddy, and he pulls out the little, little gazoo thing. And he's like,
yeah, a sad note on it, right?
And it's like, well, apparently he tried to play something else, but then he bit it because it was like one of those wax ones. So then like, I don't know if anybody else remembers this, but back in the day they used to have like wax toys that you could, it was like a flute or something, and then you could play it and then you could just chew it afterwards.
What?
They used to have those. Remember, they used to have wax lips too.
Oh yeah, wax lips.
Remember those?
Yeah.
They had the same thing with toys. And then he took it and then bit it and started chewing it. And they were like, oh, we want to do another take of that. And he's like, shit!
Did you bring more than one?
He's like, I only had one. So,
I guess that shows he was really willing to go for it as an actor, but he probably was so young to it. He didn't understand that, hey, I might get this for another take, right? So probably a good learning experience right then and there.
I'm sure, yeah. I mean, of course, freshly 18, like, I mean, come on.
Yeah. I don't even know what I was doing when I was 18.
I think it was at Penn State.
All right. So how about this? Let's take a break. Let's figure out what we were doing when we were 18 years old. I probably can't remember. I don't want to remember. But when we come back, we'll talk more Valley Girl. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And apparently when I was 18 years old, I was traveling in a circus. Did you know that, Chris?
That was case 9.
Yep, that was case 9. The whole case was Wisemark with this circus. He doesn't know any tricks. So basically, I would just kind of run out on the circus floor and just kind of run in circles.
He ran into the dirt. And then this is back whenever, Barnum and Bailey was still a thing.
Yeah.
So you had the top hat.
Yep.
The long coat.
That was about it.
They had to make you did a lot of running. I mean, notice that.
I think people were really impressed by the end of it. They're like, I don't know what that guy did, but he ran for a solid 90 minutes.
That's how Forrest Gump got started.
You're right. I got pretty dizzy because it's a circle if you think about Barnum and Bailey. But, I mean.
Dirk went up everywhere, and then case 10 was born. So
all the dirt shot up in the air, and then the lion got stolen because it was so like messed up. Someone stole the lion when I kicked up all the dirt.
See? Case 11.
Yep.
Son of a...
Man, that was a good case. It was in Toronto.
I created two cases out of my one case. I had to blow it wide open.
I remember case 17 was us just reviewing other cases.
We were reviewing case 2 through 16 because case 1...
Yeah, we're trying to find the case files. We had misplaced them somewhere. Have you seen the files for our cases? No. Oh, that's a new case.
Got case 20 already lined up for you, Mark.
So I had a place and I moved, and then they got left on the moving trucks, and then that happened, and a couple of years went by, so we went to the place, that moving truck place was closed, but then they turned out they had an auction at their storage unit, someone bought all that, we traced them down, they had sold it to a pawn shop. We went to that pawn shop, and luckily it was still there. The guy was using it as a chair for his computer.
It was a hell of a case file. He had really long legs. I think the guy who owned the pawn shop was actually Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah. So
he could actually kick his legs up that high.
It was a lot of cases. But that was a good case. I mean, it was detective work. We used detective work on that one.
We did. And, I mean, we got it back in less than, 7 years? So.
Yeah.
7 years. I mean, we're not very good at it. But, I mean, you know what?
It was like True Detective. Yeah. You know, that first season takes 40 years. You know, what, 20 years? Yeah, right. That was us trying to hunt down the case file. At that point,
they're just like, hey, come here, man. Just, why don't you pick another case?
All these people are trying to hire us. No, we got to find our old case files.
How am I going to make the new files if I don't have the old ones to put them in?
We need the we need the templates. I don't want to create a new template. You know how long that takes?
You know how much one of them files cost?
Couldn't you have, like, made a template in the 17 years you've been looking?
Made a template? Is that a joke? Coffee gets thrown across the
room. Listen to you. You.
You file-making, template-having son of a...
And that's when we went out of business for a while, because we weren't bringing in money.
So we had to do case 22 to get back to case 21.
Yep, to make more money to resume our 21. Well, that became 23. All right, so, hey, where's the money we made? We got case 24.
Blew it all on lemon mines.
You know what I do love a lot about this movie, and you touched on this earlier, are... So when they showed the party scenes in the valley, they had very different gels to use the lighting and different a color palette. So they would use pink, yellows, those kinds. And then they would also, when you watch the party scene where Nick Cage gets beat up, there's a lot of red gels that they put on the lights to give a red hue to it. And then when they went downtown, there was more dark, grungy. So it was really smart of them.
You really can see the contrast between the valley and the Hollywood life that people lived.
They established two different color palettes on a $3,000 budget, which is really impressive. And they only had $500 for the prom scene. So they had this big, but that's brilliant. They just used the streamers to block all the walls. And then everyone, they had
a lot of curtains that they just pulled that matched the stream. They got streams that matched the curtains. So then everything could just blend in right there.
And then they promoted the suits and clothes. The people wore them and they got those for free. Yep. But then they had to worry about the fighting frats breaking all their stuff, which is crazy. They
crashed through the wall with their car.
Yeah.
The one job I would not have wanted would be locations on this movie. Can you imagine explaining that to the... It was at a college that they shot the... Exterior was at a college, but interior was at a high school.
Yeah, an abandoned high school.
There we go.
Which is pretty interesting that they just... I mean, that's cool that they found an abandoned high school to shoot in. That saves some money.
I mean, that's how Russ Meyer did a lot of his. And why is the name escaping me right
Kramer
now?
Kramer versus Kramer.
Kramer. The guy who did Kramer versus Kramer. They had found an abandoned courthouse.
Abandoned house in the suburbs.
Who knew that the law wouldn't work in these areas? It's just, I mean, they saw it.
They shot an abandoned. They found the judge was the grip.
Gosh, why does his name escape me? He's like 94 years old. He still makes movies. The cheapest man in the world. What's his name? Gosh, what he did the Death Race films.
Roger Corman.
Yeah. I listened to an interview with him at the age of 93. So this was like last year, and he said he's like, okay, you want to know how to make a movie? Think about a guy you haven't seen in a movie in about 10 years. Boom, you got yourself an actor. All right, now make some phone calls to local areas. Find out who's got abandoned buildings. There, you got your locations. So he talks about this like. What was it? Death Race. Not the last one, but there was like two.
2000.
It's like, was it? No, it wasn't 2000 because Death Race 2000 was in the '70s. It was like Death Race like 2020 or was it Death Race 3000? I can't remember. But anyways, the one that was made like a couple years ago. But he was like said that he's like, okay, so I found this place in Ireland. They're gonna blow up their high school. Boom! The end of the movie, the whole place blows up.
That's brilliant, though.
It's genius. The movies, I mean, they sell. I mean, we talk about them, so obviously it works.
How much did you pay for this interview? How much is that camera?
All right, now we got case 37.
Here's what you do. You find you find a guy who's going bankrupt. Buy his lights. Right?
That's literally what he talks about.
Are there any rental industries going out? Go buy their lights.
Like, it's even better with the internet now because everyone puts everything on lights. You just type it in there. Who's going out of business? Bam, got everything.
Guess what you should use? The sun. Free. Free lighting.
Get a big piece of glass. magnifies it. Boom. Brightly lit scene. You're in the desert now.
Yeah, don't stand under it for too long.
You get 30 minutes tops.
You will burn. But it will be free.
Find a beach house that's going out of business. You got yourself SPF.
Do you not afford, flags and gels? Can you not get a big, shade for you to be over you? Some silks? Stand under a tree.
I see a lot of dead trees here. Why aren't we cutting them down?
Okay. That's wood. When it gets cold, we'll use that for firewood on my sets.
You got yourself heat and you got blockage. Bam. Yeah. I'll get in there. Let's make this movie. It's just like,
oh, we're done.
It's so funny, like, listening to him talk about making movies. But it's like, they use a lot of these techniques, like, kind of like what they did with you know, with Valley Girl, they did like a lot of the people did work for free. A lot of people did bring their own clothing.
You know what's a great monster? An invisible one.
Hey,
It Follows.
You know, look, we got It Follows. We got A Quiet Place. We got Bird Box. You ain't seen squat.
But guess what? Everyone thinks they're there.
Yeah, I'm terrified.
The happening. What's happening? Just don't show your monster because you don't need him. It's wind.
All we got to have is we need to have a Mark Wahlberg sitting there going like, I don't care if I die. I got to be in there with you.
Where's the wind?
I don't see anybody wind. I don't see no wind. Exactly.
Yeah. Free monsters. Make a movie.
I mean, it works.
Yep. Need an ocean? Shoot on a pond. Need a pond? Bathtub.
I read an interview with Kevin Costner recently. He talked about it. He's like, I don't know why everybody still hates on Waterworld. He's like, you go overseas, everyone talks about it. They're saying, when are you making part two? I was like, I beg to differ on that one, Mr. Costner.
That movie spiraled out of control. That's, you know, they built that entire atoll and dragged it out to the ocean.
That is insane.
Yeah.
I've read stories about people getting lost out there for like days. They just jump on a
castaway
and they just, and then they come back. They find out, like, you know, they're
crazy eyed and sunburnt with hair that's like shooting up like Einstein.
They got like ZZ Top style beards, and you're just like,
they just found some crew members on an island 20 some years later.
They asked if they could hang a flag, and then they were like, okay, he's good now.
I'm not leaving this island.
Roger Corman said I was hired.
Yeah. I was working on Waterworld, got hired by Roger Corman. Roger Corman came up to us after the movie. Hey, can I use these sets? Hey, you know, that's a smart idea.
Well, they did that. There's been a number of movies I've worked on. That, actually,
they did that.
A lot of Christmas movies do that. They'll wait till like the first week of January, then they'll show up and just say, "Hey, we'll shoot a Christmas movie here. We'll pay you like a couple of like $1,000 to just leave it up for another week." And they're like, and the town's like, "Of course, go ahead, because we're gonna leave them up anyways, because most Christmas decorations don't come down till like the second or third week of January." So they're like, "Oh, okay, well, we'll just leave them up there, and we're being paid for it anyways." But it saves the production a ton of money rather than going out and buying it.
Was that My Frickin' Christmas thing? Did you work on that one?
I did, but I was only there for the driving scenes. If you watch him driving, it's actually me.
Oh, hey,
yeah,
Chris Kelly, that's driver. True.
That was a fun.
You weren't
fun
even day. In a car. You were just pretending to drive.
Roger Corman produced it, so it was just me on a green screen. You can just if you can recognize the knuckles.
There's three people pushing a car. Get eight broken down cars. Get people behind them to push.
You pay them $50 each. Just go to the local carnival.
If your car's not run, shoot. Have it go down a hill. It looks like it's driving.
Well, they did Death Race. They just put styrofoam around go-karts or bumper cars.
Yeah.
That's all they got them. So it's like, it's the future. We have tiny wheels.
Now, let's see. What did we... I guess we should get back up into the... there's a lot of bathroom shenanigans in this movie.
There is.
And Martha Coolidge says she associates like sexy times with bathrooms. So you had Nick Cage hiding in the bathroom.
So did Chuck Berry.
Really? Interesting. And then you had...
That's a whole other discussion that would make this not PG-13.
Now, is this true that the... So Nick Cage gets broken up with, then he goes and hooks up with a girl in the Viper Club's women's restroom.
And
she's the girl on the poster.
Yes. That is true. She's the original girl on the original poster.
Deborah Foreman is not on the poster.
No, because in the commentary, they said that Nicolas Cage's ex-girlfriend in the movie is prettier. So they wanted to market her instead.
Wow.
It's true. I mean, I don't know if that would work, if that worked or not, but I would have saw this movie regardless. I told you, I saw this movie when I was 12, and it was on VH1 back when VH1 used to do their flashback weekends, and they would show stuff from the 70s and 80s, and this was part of their 80s weekend, and they played this, and I forget the other movies that they played, but then they would also do their behind the music with like the Go-Go's and... It was back when VH1 was an enjoyable.
What did you think about Cage back in the day? Did you like him?
Well,
when you were 12.
When I was 12, this would have been like Matchstick Men didn't even come out yet. That's how long ago that was. This was very shortly after we had gone to see Con Air. Because whenever I was a lot younger, we used to go see movies because both my parents were in the military. We would go to this military base and they would show movies for cheap. So we would go there every weekend. We would watch whatever movie that they were playing. And I think we just watched Con Air at the time. And then whenever the following weekend, or maybe like the next month, I can't remember. But I watched Valley Girl, and I was like, oh my God, that's the guy from Con Air.
Where's his mullet?
Yeah. Why is he? He's only like in his early 30s. Why does he look like he's 50?
Yeah.
I mean, he's like 35, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
Like, my God, he looks so old.
Because that was what? So 83, right? That movie was what? 98?
96.
96, Con Air? Con Air was 96?
It's like 96, 97.
All right. So he was 15 years. Yeah, you're right.
He would have been, yeah. He looks a lot older than he would have been, because he does not look like how we would.
Yeah, exactly. But when he looks 18, he looked older, too. I was surprised to learn that he was 18.
And somehow he looks like he would be his age now. But then when I watched Mandy, he looked younger to me.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't look like he was almost 60. Is he 60?
Well, he was 18 in 83.
So he was almost 60.
Like, yeah, so 50s. At 36, what, or 37, oh, wait, no, 83. I don't want to do math, man. 37.
We'll just say, like, late 50s.
Yeah, middle 50s, 55.
At least 30 years, so that's definitely at least almost 50. So.
Hey, we're good at math, guys. Don't worry about that, all right? We know math.
My English ain't so good either.
Yeah. So I don't know. Let's see, what else did we... what about the scene where he gets broken up with and his buddy's like, you gotta win her back by all the crazy methods.
Yeah.
So, all right, does he get a job at the theater?
I think he does, or maybe he just kind of shows up. I like how he... the one I like the most was whenever he's the chef. And he actually showed up with a chef hat. That was his actual hat. And he was just like, I want to wear it. And Martha was like, go for it. And he walks out. And that was all improv. His whole like, well, Peter Piper picked a pack of peppers. And then he comes and he like, you know, the gum comes out of his mouth. And then he grabs it off the guy's shirt, puts it back in his mouth.
That was improv, right?
It was all improv. And he thought of that all on his own. I love that scene. That's great. And I love the how he goes to the movie theater. It's like, it's cute at the same time. I mean, like, I guess if you look at it like in another light, it's really stalkerish.
And he's sleeping on her lawn in a sleeping bag.
He wakes up.
So the same thing. I'm going to ask you. So in Say Anything, there's that scene where he stands outside her window with the boombox playing the song when they first hooked up. Now, in hindsight, yes. Would I ever do that? No. Would I work at a movie theater or work at a chef's place or sleep on someone's lawn? No. But they are like 18-year-old kids in movies.
Yeah.
So, and you know, you don't think about the Do you think about the creepy... Cage wasn't thinking about the creepy consequences of what he was doing.
I don't think anyone did, because the music's a little bit more lighthearted. It's not like, you know, they're not playing like Demiurge Gear or something whenever he shows up and it's like, oh my God. But it is kind of cute. Yeah. I would think it would be cute. Not unless there was like serious ill will, but we all knew that, you know, Deborah didn't really want to break up with Nick. So their names in the movie is, I can't remember.
Julie
and Randy.
Randy.
So it's like, you know, she didn't really want to break up with him. So it's kind of cute that he also is like saying, I don't want to break up with you either. So I'll just kind of, you know, very smallly interject myself in your life. Also the book with the pictures in it. Nicolas Cage actually went out and got those pictures like on his own time.
Wow.
Like he showed up to it because this was back in the day when malls used to have, they would have photo booths. Like, I don't know if they have them now. I haven't been to a mall in forever, but they, he went in there, took these photos, and then he put them in the book.
Right.
It's cute. Yeah. I thought that was really cute.
And the context of the world, it was meant to be lighthearted.
Yes.
And if you did it in this world, it would just be a little much.
I think girls would, or women would definitely be freaked out. If you just show, if like, you know, you show up and you're sleeping on their yard.
Yeah.
I know my girlfriend would be terrified if she broke up with me and then I'm like sleeping in her hallway.
Yeah.
Just like, you have a house, Chris. You do.
Leave.
Get out of here.
Maybe he was actually sleeping out there. And I got to say, so at the end, I want to talk about one of my favorite things. So Nick Cage shows up to the prom eventually to win her back.
Yeah.
And he does a flying nut kick to Tommy.
Yeah, he nails him. I love that. It's Tommy's fault, though, because he's showing off. He pops him. He's like, I'm going to give you the chance. I'm going to give you the chance you never gave me. Pops him. Tommy gets up, nails him back. And then he goes to take off his jacket and everything. And he does his karate moves. And then he turns to Julie. And then he's like, all right, watch this. And then wham, right in the balls. I love how the band...
What is this, Bangkok?
Just standing there looking at him. Like, they're like, yeah.
I mean, Tommy would win the fight. So,
Tommy would destroy
Cage him. Was right in kicking him in the balls.
Of course.
He's Hollywood rules. I mean, Valley people probably don't think about nut kicks. I feel like Valley people fight fair. Well, they probably fight with numbers more. But Cage does a flying nut kick, and then a food fight breaks out. And then they do one of their two graduate, Martha Coolidge's two graduate missions.
They get into the limo.
Crap, I was going to open this. So I did the intro. I just kind of let it happen. But I was going to do, joining me is a man who wished he got into the plastic industry. It's Chris Kelly. Because plastics. Yeah.
When you think of Chris Kelly, you think of plastics.
But I like that they just did a random plastics graduate nod. And at the end, but the end of this one ended happier than the end of Graduate. Because on Graduate, Mike Nichols just left the camera on them to linger. And then they both went, holy crap, we're in a lot of trouble. But in this one, they're smiling. She throws the bracelet and...
Yeah, she throws it out and you see them driving down the highway and I Melt With You, which wasn't a hit. Wasn't a hit at the time. And Martha talked about in the commentary that she heard that song on the radio and says, I don't care. I want to have this song in my movie and because it's so perfect. And of course, with this movie, it became a hit. So the song I Melt With You would probably not have been as big as a hit if it wasn't for this movie.
And I love when she first heard it, she couldn't sing it. So she told the guy, this is a song I want. And she's like, go find it. And the guy's like, what? There was no internet, right?
I mean, the most he could really do would go to a record store and just say, hey, do you have this song?
And, gotcha. If I would be a jerk employee, I'd be like, do it again? One more time?
That must be what, whenever I go to the record shop and I ask them, hey, do you have anything that's good with this record too?
Sounds like Sinatra.
Yeah. You walk in there with the cramps and they're like, oh, well, you want Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
They go great together.
Hey, Martha, I bought this Tony Bennett album. What?
All of a sudden, Rags to Riches starts blaring.
What I like about this movie, and I appreciate you bringing it to me, is introducing this to me, is that it's just such a good, it's a movie that wasn't supposed to be good, but it was good, and it was a hit, and it still feels genuine to this day.
And it's also, it's a movie, even whenever I saw it as a young boy.
Lad.
A young lad. I didn't know this movie existed, of course, you know, I mean, because it was a popular movie at the time. It was very big cultural, like, impact. It was great, like, you know, whenever you watch movies and they really capture what it was at the time. And I love that about this movie. And it really did capture what life was like. And she says that in the commentary that she was like, I really wanted to capture what it was like in the Valley and Hollywood at the time.
Because she worked in the clubs. She said she would go to clubs 5 nights a week because her first movie was going to be like a musical rock love story. So the clubs that she shot in, there was some authenticity there. She knew the bands. She knew, I don't know, there was a good vibe for all of that. So quick question though for you. We had this for our podcast. We got a question. And I want to ask you, what two movies kind of capture the essence of Nick Cage's career? If aliens came down to Earth and said, show me two movies that encapsulate all of Nick Cage's career, what are they? What two movies? So if you had to pick two in his entire filmography to show... So there's many Cages. There's Bored Nick Cage and Next and other movies. Then there's Bonkers Nick Cage.
And everything made Kiss. After 2007.
And then, well, no, but
or
he...
2000, yeah.
I mean, he did Adaptation. He was nominated for an Oscar for that in the 2000. Yeah.
There's Alcoholic Nick Cage, which was Leaving Las Vegas.
That's right. And then there's Mandy, which is just Nick Cage... His manic acting used really well. There's Joe by David Gordon Green. That's burly Nick Cage used really well. So it's like
he's a really good actor.
Yeah,
I think that like in recent times he got a bum rap because I mean we all remember The Wicker Man.
And he needs to make money. That's why he kept making all these movies.
Yeah, did you read about that? He dropped like $2 million on a Tyrannosaurus Rex skull.
Exactly.
Like, so his son is like a death metal musician. So I guess. He's like, yeah, look up photos of him. He looks like a buff Marilyn Manson.
Really?
Yeah. So he's huge too.
He's trying to make, so he's just trying to make money right now because of, you know, real estate, all this kind of stuff. So he's just churning out movies.
He does smart things too. I mean, he knows that like he goes to movies that, he picks movies that are low budget and then he, says that he'll take like, it's like a $6 million film. He'll take $2 million of the budget. And it's like that, I know it sounds shitty to do, but
it's 15 days.
Exactly. It sounds like you're kind of, you know, shitting on people. But at the same time, he knows that if he does that, that movie will then sell for at least 15, 20 million. So it's like they don't really mind giving him, you know, a third of the budget because it's like, well, we're going to get it back anyways because it has Nicolas Cage in it.
Yeah,
even his bad movies sell.
He was in two good movies this year, or 2018, Mom and Dad. And
I have yet to see that. That looks so good.
Mom and Dad and Mandy. No, I felt Mom and Dad... It's about parents trying to kill their children, but
It's like a disease, isn't it? Yeah. That they all get infected. So kind of like cooties, but it's like...
Yeah, exactly. But if you and I are hanging out, right, and then you have your kid, you just go kill your kid, then you come back to me, okay, Mark, you want to go get some coffee? It's like a weird movie. But they kind of... There's a couple Nick Cage freakouts in Mom and Dad that I feel like are quite exploitive. They don't feel organic to his freakouts.
Like they told him, hey, we need you to go full Nick Cage in this scene?
Yeah, and there wasn't much context for it, so it just felt... It felt exploitative, but Mandy, when he does lose it, I mean, there's a reason to lose it.
Oh my God. I saw that movie and I was like, when I saw that movie eventually, cause it took me forever to eventually get into it because it's such an incredibly slow burn of a film. And then when it does hit, it hits and it's hard.
And it's like waiting for a wave. And then the wave comes. It's like a tidal wave.
Yeah. you're like sitting at the beach waiting on a wave. And then all of a sudden one, the size of like, of like the Statue of Liberty comes flying at you. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I loved it. I loved the way he acted in it. And it's just like the more ridiculous it gets, it's like the guy pulls out a chainsaw. Now he has a chainsaw. What is going on?
Monologues.
I liked in your the previous podcast, it was like the best use of a non-Cenobite as a Cenobite.
Yeah.
I burst out laughing when I heard that.
Those
I
was like, that's crazy.
That was perfect. I loved it. And the whole hippie cult thing.
Yeah.
So crazy.
But they used him so well, right? They used him
perfectly. Yeah. Perfectly used. And it's like, well, they would use, you would need a Nicolas Cage type of acting caliber for that film because it's like, I don't know, could you see Heath Ledger doing that or Jake Gyllenhaal? But if you wanted to do an older actor, who would you need? Like Tom Wopat?
I don't think so. Keanu.
Keanu Reeves?
Not Keanu. Not Keanu. Oof,
remember that?
But
why are you doing this? See? No.
I cannot.
That movie comes to a screeching halt to me every time. I love the beginning of that movie, and I love the cinematography, and I love Keanu's acting in the beginning of it. But then whenever they're like, what's the phrase? 15 gets you 20. I'm like, oh, there is no way I believe that these two women are like, she looks like she's 30 because, you know, she was 30 when she made it. It's like, I have mad props to Eli Roth for having a gorgeous wife, but come on, man.
Yeah, that was a little much.
It's like, come on.
But so, Nick Cage's four favorite movies that he has done are Bad Lieutenant.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Vampire's Kiss, Leaving Las Vegas, and Face Off. So those are his four favorite movies that he's done. And I looked at his filmography and I picked these two. Adaptation.
Great movie.
Oscar nominated, plays two roles. There's absurdity. There's him flop sweating. There's enough of his quirk in it. And it showcases that he's actually a very good actor.
He does a lot of range in that movie.
And then Face Off, because he plays two different characters in that as well. So the reason I picked these two movies is you get four variations of Nick Cage. So you get the Kaufman brothers in Adaptation, and then you get Bad Nick Cage, and then you get Face Off, normal, nice Nick Cage. So he's out of his gourd, because then Travolta's the bad guy, and then he becomes the good guy, but then he has to overact.
He has to pretend to be the bad guy.
Yeah, so you get four different Cages in two movies. That's why I picked Adaptation and Face Off. What two did you think?
I chose Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
David Lynch. I love that movie. The beginning of that film, whenever they're going to the dance and everything, and they're playing that, I forget the name of the song, but they're playing
Wild
the song.
At Heart.
They're playing the song, and it's him and Laura Dern going in, and the guy that's there to basically kill Nicolas Cage, and he stops him, and he starts talking to him for a minute. He's like, hey, blah, blah, blah. He's like, you know, I'm supposed to kill you. Nicolas Cage just grabs the guy, beats him, and then throws his head against the wall, like, and then he's like covered in blood, and Laura Dern's like, oh my God, what did you just do? And he's like, come on, baby, we got a dance to go to. So it's like, oh my Lord.
Yep.
And then of course he goes to jail, gets out, and the movie, it's a very, you know, and he says like he would never marry a woman unless he could sing I Can't Help Falling in Love, I think that's the name of the song, to her.
Elvis.
Yep. He's a massive Elvis Presley.
You mean
fan.
UB40.
Yeah. I think you are drastically mistaken, sir. It is. If there's one thing I know about Ukrainian reggae music.
Yeah, from Sliver. Was that on the Sliver soundtrack?
It was on the Sliver soundtrack. That's actually not a bad record. I have that one. Red Wine, and that's a good song too. I don't care what people say. You know, that's a great one.
So Wild at Heart. And...
Wild at Heart. And I mean, it's just, it shows his range. And then, of course, at the end, whenever he's presumably dead, and then the two fairies come out, which is, you know, very much like in Godzilla, the two for the Mothra fairies come out and they start talking to him, saying like, no, you cannot die now. You're wild at heart. And he says, I gotta go. I can't fall in love with a woman. I'm wild at heart, baby. I gotta go. And it's just, it's such a bonkers movie.
Yeah.
And he used a lot of his own wardrobe for that film as well.
It's awesome.
And then of course he gets up and, you know, he's like, you know, he gets on Laura Dern's car and he just, wild man. It's so beautiful. It's a beautiful, like, little romantic drama. Very weird.
I like when Lynch is grounded in his weirdness. Does that make sense? This movie,
Lost Highway?
Yeah, well,
Lost Highway. That's a four-part podcast.
I'm calling you at your house, right?
I love that scene.
I like when there's, I don't know, if Wild Heart feels kind of grounded, but it's also really weird. It's not super, like, you can follow the narrative.
It's kind of like him doing a mainstream movie.
Yeah, but it's a David Lynch version of a mainstream movie.
We tried that with Elephant Man, but I don't think he had much to do with it other than, like, he probably talked about the shots, but that was very much a studio film.
Yeah, so that's why I kind of like it. It's a mainstream, it's like a love story, but it's a David Lynch movie.
Yes.
But it doesn't feel like Mulholland Drive.
No, yeah, it's very much like a mainstream film, but it is David Lynch. It's like a David Lynch version of a mainstream film, exactly like what you said.
Yeah, thank you.
Excuse me, my ego's just been inflated.
Let's take a break. Case 38. Where's Mark's ego?
The other one I picked was Lord of War.
Oh, yeah.
2005 classic.
Very good.
You know, Jared Leto plays a drug-addicted brother. Man, Jared Leto at that time, he was just playing drug addicts.
Requiem for a Dream.
Just bounced one right after the next. He's like, when I get older, I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to play the Joker.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be in Dallas Buyers Club. That's not going to be a drug-addicted film either.
And that's Ethan Hawke in that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke's also in that too.
What a great cast.
Is it? Yeah, dynamite film. And it was at the time whenever... Nicolas Cage was doing his movies where he was going full Nick Cage, which this was also at the same time as The Wicker Man. And there was a lot of other movies that he was doing where he was just screaming and throwing things around. Of course, this is nearly a decade after Kiss of Death, where he just walks into the bar, screams at the one random guy and says, F you.
Yeah, a BMF. Isn't he a BMF in that movie?
what was the one scene? Oh, bring it back to the original question. Like, what movie would I want to be an extra on? It would not have been Kiss of Death, because whenever he's walking out of the bar and he grabs the random extra. I don't know if the extra even knew what was going on or if he was actually a stunt guy. He may have been, but he grabs him and throws him on the ground.
Yeah.
And the guy looks shocked because he's like, whoa, I'm just supposed to be standing here. But that was Nicolas Cage back in those days.
He was beefy in that movie. He was a big guy. He was threatening, physically frightening.
Yeah, he was a big fella.
Beefy.
All right. But I chose Lord of War because it was just, it really showed his range of acting. And he was portraying a real character, Victor Bout, who was a Soviet Union arms dealer. But I love the line that he says in Lord of War when he says he sold guns to literally everybody and weapons to every person you can imagine. He goes, except Osama bin Laden. He's like, not because of any morals, but because his checks would always bounce. Just such a great line.
Yeah, that movie is refreshing too, because it does show you that he can dial it back.
Yeah, and he is a real actor, and you can really see that in those films.
Yeah, then you have you're right.
You do have like the nutty stuff that he's done, and of course, what was the last?
He's not winking at the camera.
Yeah. He's not Jimmy Fallon.
I do. I do like his National Treasure movies. I love him in.
Those are fun to watch.
He's a lead in that one. Does that make, so he's a lead in most of his movies, but in this one he's just like a Disney lead, like the male lead.
Yeah, he's very, very clean cut. Very, like he's not. Although he is an adventurer, he's not like dirty. He's not. He's not Indiana Jones. You know.
They even have a scene where they buy new clothes, and they buy very nice clothes. And it's like a half-hour dressing scene where they each drop out $700.
God dang.
Well, I want to do the math on the clothes they bought.
They bought them from the guys from 30 Days a Night, the vampires from 30 Days a Night.
They're $500 for that jacket.
Like,
is that a yes?
Two bottles of blood?
Yeah.
You drive a hard bargain there.
All right, I guess, where's the blood van? All right, so... Now, we kind of had this thing where we said who was the MVP of the 1980s romance movies, but I kind of want to do your recommendations because that could take us a while. So me, I just want to answer that real quick and say John Cusack. Now, Nick Cage had Peggy Sue Got Married. He had Moonstruck. He had Valley Girl. But in
Peggy Sue Got Married, he's not the he's kind of like a background. He's like
I guess because he's in it. I guess. Yeah. Right? But for me, I immediately went to like a Diane Keaton. I was thinking about Meg Ryan. But
that's more of 90s, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right? That, yeah.
And then that Joe Keaton versus would have been 70s.
Yeah, because 77 was Annie Hall.
Yeah, but I love it.
Was
that weird. Movie
I thought
so
I thought Annie Hall was in the 80s. I thought Joe versus Volcano was in the 80s.
Joe versus Volcano was
90.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was 86.
Yeah, see, that's what I. Yeah. And but I was I just went easy. I went not very creative for me, but John Cusack, because of Say Anything, Better Off Dead, The Sure Thing, and One Crazy Summer. I've watched all those movies countless times. I thought he was the coolest kind of romantic lead in the 1980s because he wasn't the jerk.
He was like Nicolas Cage in Valley Girl.
Yeah,
he was like the punk rock guy that he was like, he was cool and lovable. And, you know, his girlfriend was always the polar opposite of who
he was. But he wasn't Tommy, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
It's almost like Valley Girl kind of laid the foundation for all of this.
Yeah. You know, Say Anything, Lloyd Dobler, Diane Court. And also what I liked about Lloyd Dobler is he was a nice guy. But he could beat you up. Like, he was a karate. He was good at kickboxing. So he's a nice dude who could also probably lay out. I liked him in Better Off Dead because he's just so weird. And then The Sure Thing, he and Daphne Zuniga, I love their chemistry. And then One Crazy Summer is just weird. Him and Demi Moore hoops. And then he had a cameo. He was in 16 Candles, but he wasn't one of the core.
Yeah, he was one of the dorks. He put a bra on his head. Yeah. They also did that in a Weird Science, remember that?
Oh, yeah. A lot of bras on heads in the 80s.
Why was that? Right. Why was that a thing?
I picked the Q.
My first thought whenever you had texted me this was my first immediate reaction was C. Thomas Howell for some reason.
Interesting.
Because I always pictured him as more of like an 80s name. Because he did dominate the 80s. He had a ton of movies.
Outsiders.
Did Outsiders, Red Dawn. Soul Man, which I don't know how that movie even got made. Oof, that was a rough one. Try watching that one nowadays.
If you just say like, that to somebody. Hey, C. Thomas, Soul Man. I was watching clips from North the other day. Remember that movie with Elijah Craig?
It had Bruce Willis.
Kathy Bates and another guy, I think Abe Bogota.
Abe Bogota was in that?
I don't know, maybe. But they were in brownface for Native American Inuits. Ooh. And you're like, Kathy Bates. Like,
and then here we are with the Lone Ranger and Johnny Depp.
Tonto. But yeah, whatever. But yeah, that was read the review that Ebert wrote about North. You'll get a good laugh. He hates that movie.
It was a bad movie. Yeah. I didn't even like it when it came out.
Horrible.
It was stupid. I mean, yeah. I was like the age of that kid, too. It was like, I would have been like 10 or 11 when it came out.
I was like, so. You got it easy, kid.
What are you complaining about?
I bet you kids who actually had bad lives watched that movie and went, I hate this child.
But my first thoughts were going to see Thomas Howell because he did Secret Admirer. Soul Man, regardless of the plot of the film, I don't know how she falls in love with him. But anyways, I would figure he probably would have just got beat up. But she does fall in love with him. So it is kind of like a romantic comedy, even though it is very backwards way. And then he did Return of the Musketeers. So he had certain films throughout the 80s where he was doing a lot of romantic comedies, and they were dropped like sporadically. It was 85, 86, and 89.
So he was just a lot of 80s. C. Thomas Howell is what you're saying.
And he did a lot of movies and TV shows in the 80s. And then in the 90s, he just kind of petered out. And now he just plays kind of like Matthew Modine, is just kind of like a background supporting character in various films, which, you know, I'm at their age, why not?
Matthew Modine had a good run in Stranger Things.
Yeah, the great run in almost every movie he does. He did, 47 Meters Down.
Yep.
And then in a movie that I worked on, which I finally is now on demand, An Actor Prepares, he plays a character in that too.
Nice.
So
the Mo Dean.
Yeah.
All right. So,
I went to him, but then I started doing more research. And after doing more research, I found that Patrick Dempsey.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been the guy who would have been the real king of the 80s rom-coms.
I mean, Can't Buy Me Love.
Heaven Help Us, In the Mood. As you said, Can't Buy Me Love, In a Shallow Grave, Some Girls, Lover Boy, and Happy Together. That spans from 85 to 89.
Yeah, he had a long run there.
Yeah, he was killing it left and right. And he did a lot of movies, and he was very classically handsome. Even to this day, he's still a very handsome man. He plays
his name McDreamy? Isn't that what his name? There's a McDreamy, there's a McSteamy. Grey's Anatomy. You know that? Those are their nicknames.
I never watched the show.
Yeah, in Grey's Anatomy, there's a Dr. McDreamy and there's a Dr. McSteamy.
Is that what his name is?
I think he was McDreamy.
I mean, he's a good-looking guy.
McDreamy.
Still very good-looking.
All right. So you pick the Demps.
I say Patrick Dempsey, but some honorable mentions. I mean, you already said John Cusack. Tom Cruise, which, you know, we know now people associate Tom Cruise as more as like an action star now, which is kind of crazy to think about considering he's in his 50s. He's still doing extremely well and still doing really cool stunts and movies.
Molly Ringwald.
That's a great. I wrote down for women. I did men and women. Tom Cruise. I mean, he did Losing It, Risky Business,
Cocktail,
which brought the Beach Boys back.
Top Gun.
Was that what would you call it? A romantic comedy?
Well, romance. I guess it has romance in it, right?
Yeah. I guess you. I guess you could lean that.
Yeah.
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 But, you know, and then All the Right Moves, which I guess you could chalk that up to the same thing as Top Gun. But all those movies just came out like boom right after the other. Then he just kind of did more like action films in the mid 80s or more kind of like mid 20s characters. And then I guess when Cocktail happened, he was like, I'm going to try to be more of an adult, which take it or leave it.
Yeah. It was time.
It's a fun movie to watch. It's not a bad film. It's not like, you could watch, Patrick Swayze movies and you're still like, you watch them nowadays and it's like, I watched Roadhouse and I was like, oh my God, how did this happen?
Best Tai Chi in a movie ever.
Best lines in a movie ever. Yeah. The most intimidating lines ever. Jeez Louise. And for women, as far as 80s rom-coms went, everybody just immediately goes to Molly Ringwald, obviously, because 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink. But she also did The Pickup Artist and For Keeps. And those movies were, that spanned from 1984 to 1988, so she was turning them out one right after, kind of like one right after the other. But then when she turned down John Hughes, that was kind of like when her career went to shit because she wanted to be taken seriously as an actress and as a woman, as opposed to John Hughes, who was forever stuck in high school, say what you will about his movies. Sometimes when you're in your 50s, you gotta let go of the fact that you went to high school. But Blink-182 is still going strong, so I don't know.
Yeah, I love Blink-182.
California was a little bit of a rough record. It was not. The first song was okay.
A Grammy nomination for that.
Yeah, well, you best know, Elvis only won one Grammy ever, and that was for Best Gospel Record. So
you're comparing Elvis to Blink-182? No,
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, one.
Yeah, exactly. See, Blink, like that. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Blink, and Elvis. I'm a grown man, and everyone has their own opinion, but when people start hating on Blink, I'm like, All right, so what else?
Put on my Dickie shorts. Yeah.
I thought about Julia Roberts as well, but she controlled the 90s. She had Steel Magnolia and, Fry Greenton. Steel Magnolia
is the 90s.
She had that great line in what Steel Magnolia is about. I would rather love somebody for 30 seconds with all my heart, something like that, the wedding scene.
Been, I don't know how many years since I've seen that.
I got a big clip on Valentine's Day. I did some work for Rotten Tomatoes. There's a video coming out. You'll see. So now I know like every Julia Roberts movie.
Oh,
ever.
Man.
So you'll see
hear about Notting Hill.
Yeah. Oh, I love Notting Hill.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I've never seen that in theaters.
I'm just a girl asking a boy. Oopsie daisy. All right. So who else you got?
And then Mary Stuart Masterson.
Oh, yeah.
Who did Some Kind of Wonderful. She was like the tomboy in every... Her name was Tomboy in the Some Kind of Wonderful. But that was a cute movie. That was one of the ones I was going to say as a reference, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. But then she did, Chances Are, Mr. North, Heaven Help Us. She always played kind of like the rough and tough girl that liked the boy, but the boy was supposed to be in love with the model-esque girl. But then she sometimes would get the boy, but sometimes not. And she was really good. She did a lot of rom-coms in the 80s. Nice. And then, of course, she was mostly famous for playing Iggy in Fried Green Tomatoes.
Iggy.
Yeah. She was great. I love her.
Oh, yeah, man.
She's a great actress.
You got some recs for me?
I do. I do like to reference a couple of movies that just in case, people are listening to this and they go, oh, well, I want to watch Valley Girl now. And they do. And they like that. You could just go on the internet and look up other movies to watch that are like Valley Girl. But, sometimes it's always nice to just hear what somebody who likes that movie references. And I have to say one of the movies that's a great one to go along with this is Romancing the Stone.
Oh, yeah. Adventure. It's a good adventure yarn.
It's great.
Yeah.
Kind of a dumb plot, but it's great.
It's fun, though.
She goes, like, her sister gets kidnapped by, like, drug lords. So she goes in to go get her, and then she meets up with Michael Douglas, who's, like, this insanely handsome man. And
he's rakish. He's a rogue.
And it was, like, right before Indiana Jones was a thing. So it was all kind of that whole adventure moment. It's a fun movie to watch.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Something kind of fun to fun fact about that movie is that they originally were not going to use Michael Douglas, despite the fact that he produced it.
Wow.
Because they wouldn't take him seriously as an actor because of his dad, Kirk. So he talked about this on WTF with Marc Maron, saying that it took him a long time. Even when his movies were being produced, it was hard for him to actually get a role in a movie. But this was like the movie when he did it. The rest of the producing world was like, okay, we believe him as an actor now. So if it weren't for Romancing the Stone, where he had to give everything into it, he probably wouldn't have had that big of a career.
And it'd be fun. It's fun to see him as that role too, because you don't get to see the Michael Douglas adventurer much. Yeah. So it's, if you know, you watch the Kominsky Method, I think he won an award for that recently at the Golden Globes. It's just fun to see him as a rakish.
Yeah, he's very like rough and tough.
Yeah.
You know, gets the girl type of guy, permanently has a 5 o'clock shadow.
Always.
Covered in dirt. And it's a fun movie to watch.
Awesome.
Another one which I just talked about, which was Some Kind of Wonderful, which was written by John Hughes. So it's very much done in the same vein as the 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, that whole type of feel. And Some Kind of Wonderful is one of those movies that I would strongly recommend to watch. If you do like Valley Girl, you'll probably enjoy these movies.
Sweet. So Some Kind of Wonderful and Romancing the Stone.
Mystic Pizza is also another good one.
And Kramer versus Kramer.
Kramer versus Kramer. We can't. That's the best movie. The only thing that that movie was missing was arm wrestling. So Stallone took note from that and was like, I'm going to make over the
when
top.
I turn my head back. Yeah. Well, he was dealing with his child because he wanted to have something for his kid.
Of course, the whole movie's about child custody and arm wrestling.
Someone made a funny joke, though. They're like, so he wins a new truck so he can be gone all the time on the road.
That's how he's providing
for
everyone.
When I turn my head up.
It's like flipping a switch.
Yeah.
It's like, whatever, I don't care who's across from me. It could be, you know, my best friend, they're going down. It's like the guy drinks gasoline, eats the cigar. It's like, oh my God.
That guy's going to die.
They used real professional arm wrestlers in the movie too. And it's like, it's kind of funny because that guy who's this big hulking behemoth that Stallone has to take down at that movie, in the end of the movie, it's like this guy would just murder him. It would be like that scene in The Fly.
Snap.
Cracks his arm in half.
All right, so no, that was fun, man, and thank you for introducing me to Valley Girl. I really enjoyed talking about it.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime, awesome. Man. I love referencing movies, especially people they may not have heard of them.
So. Awesome. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Chris, wants to be an extra in 1980s movies, who loves plastic, Kelly, this is Movie Sons of Flicks. We'll see you next week.